Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton Stevens. My Time Capsule is a podcast where people tell me 5 things from their lives that they wish they had in a time capsule. They can pick anything they like, but they pick 4 things that they cherish and 1 thing that they'd like to bury and forget. My special guest in this episode is the comedian Ed Patrick. Ed is, as I said, a comedian. He's also an author and an NHS anaesthetist. He's performed across the UK, including at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Ed hosts the Comedian Surgery podcast, where he speaks to guests including Joe Lycett, Rose Matafeo, and Reginald D. Hunter about their health stories and experiences. He also created and presented Infectious Personalities with Hattrick Productions, broadcast on BBC Radio 2, with the guests Charlie Brooker and Sindhu V. Ed has written and performed on BBC Radio 4 for shows such as Now Wash Your Hands and Newsjack, and he's also written for The Guardian about the intersection between medicine and comedy. He wrote a book about his experiences in the world of comedy and the NHS, particularly during COVID, called Catch Your Breath, The Secret Life of a Sleepless Anaesthetist, which is available now from all good and even some bad booksellers. And this spring, he will be touring his show, also called Catch Your Breath, around the country, finishing at London's Comedy Store on May the 6th. Book your tickets now, or maybe book them after you've listened to this podcast, where we find out what Ed Patrick would most want in his time capsule, and the one thing he'd want to put in there and keep buried forever. Hello, Ed.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. Here I am. I've only been here for a minute.
Okay.
You know that thing where they do on Zoom where they say you can put them in a waiting room?
Yes.
I think that would be like being a doctor.
No, yeah. I had to do an anaesthetics exam a couple of years ago and they put you in waiting rooms and it was just one of the most painful sorts. You just sat there twiddling your thumbs, wondering what on earth you'd said to the previous one and then now waiting for the next one. It was a nightmare.
This morning, all morning, I've been thinking about a little thing I read on your website.
Yeah.
When you said, I'm an anaesthetist, or as the Americans call it, anaesthesiologist.
Yes, that's right, yeah. I think it has a different meaning now as well.
Right.
Slightly different meaning. Oh, no, maybe it doesn't. They've got anaesthesia nurses there. Mm. There's lots of political toing and froing at the moment about associates and things like that. And then, so right. Basically, the deal is when you see someone, you won't be able to work out if they're a doctor or not. You just need to ask them directly and just say, are you a doctor? And well, you know, sort of thing.
Sort of. So, more of a decorator than a...
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, you're right. There is a lot of Americanisms they like to call their own sort of thing.
Yes, I was in America and they reported about a place being burglarized, which I thought was a nice extension of a word.
What, it's as in like thieved sort of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, burgled.
Oh, I've just made up a word, thieved.
Thievization, obviously, yes. But then again, you come from the world of medicine.
I know, there's loads of words that I still don't even know or understand in medicine. So, in fact, my mum bought me once a book on sort of, it's like a dictionary of doctor's words. And so I read through some of them and obviously some of the Latin that I really recognise. But there's absolutely hundreds I've never heard of or since, because you just don't have the time. You go into a certain field and then you don't, you know, I'm not going down the sort of depths of dermatology or anything now. And you know what I mean? Like all this.
Just ignore that. I know nothing about skin. Keep away from me. I'm delighted to talk to you, I have to say, because I've been involved with the NHS in, you know, not just in the sense of being a taxpayer, so we're all involved with it, really, but I've been involved with it in the fact I sponsor a team that protests against the constant government fiction that is put out about the NHS, about it being everybody else's fault apart from theirs. I recently went to an A&E and was seen within about half an hour by a nurse and then another half an hour seen by a junior doctor. And I said to the doctor, sorry, aren't you on strike today? And he said, yeah, I am.
Yeah.
And it turned out the whole hospital was completely staffed and every doctor who worked there had come in on that day, even though the junior and senior doctors were on strike. They were all in there. And I said, what are you doing here? And they said, we're doing admin.
Oh, right.
They'd come in to clear the paperwork.
Yeah. Well, I support the strikes and the BMA the way they're doing it, because I just think that the government need to listen to them, basically. It's sort of depressing when you realise how much you're getting paid and then sort of subsequent jobs in other sectors sort of thing, and the, you know, the sort of value they're putting on it.
Mm.
And yet, you know, they don't want to do anything about it. Yet they'll throw millions and billions at Rwanda or dodgy, you know, look at all the PPE stuff and things like that. So
yeah.
They could easily... Yeah, exactly.
Madness,
and all the BMA are asking for is full pay restoration from what it was in 2008. That's all it is. And you look at MPs' salaries and how much they've gone up as well. So
yes, quite.
So yeah, but I'm surprised, because the amount it costs the government with these strikes, they could probably have saved it all by just agreeing a decent pay package, basically.
Initially, indeed.
I mean, back to the Rwanda thing, they'll throw millions and millions and millions at lawyers and things like that. And it's not going to ever be a policy that's going to be workable. We're never going to have sort of an express plane that's taking people across there.
It's clearly, they think it's effective as far as their voters are concerned, which is why they're doing it. But it won't have any effect on immigration, I don't think, at all.
No, not at all. No, it's nasty, really, more than anything else. I don't know, it's one of those depressing things going on, is it, where you just think, where's the humanity and everything?
Yeah, quite. Well, I mean, I can't imagine that anybody goes into the health service without fundamentally a desire to help people.
Yeah, well, in our country, certainly. I mean, you don't go into the NHS for money.
Mm.
You know, if you want to make lots of money, then there's plenty of other places that you could do that. Obviously, in, you know, different countries where it's, you know, sort of a private sector-led thing, like in America, then money is a thing that... But then yeah. Also coming on top of that is all the insurance and all that side of things too. So yeah, the NHS is great to work for in terms of, you know, you want to go into it because that is something that you want to do. It does. And I think that's what the government has sort of found difficult as well, when they thought they'll squeeze it and then doctors and will be tempted by all these different things. And, you know, this whole collapse of the NHS system, that isn't why people got into the NHS. So
no, I think it's highly admirable. And I just wait for an election, I think, maybe. Maybe.
I think that's it. No, that's what I think it is. I think we just need a sea change of everything. I'm not saying that the next government that come in is going to be the right one. It's just that I think it's so stagnated in the ways of what it's been. And we've gone through several health secretaries. And I mean, I'm pretty sure lots of other sectors could say the same thing.
The problem is, if you say it enough times, there's no backing down. If you say we're not going to give in, this is it. This is the final offer. You're trapped. You can't negotiate.
Yeah.
And that's the mistake they've made, I think.
Yeah, well, that's it. The BMA have really stood firmly by what they believe in and really have got the support of the majority of all the doctors, basically. So it's just costing the government more and more by them not doing it. But I don't know whether it's a political decision, do you know what I mean? Like, what are they sending out Because in my mind, I'm like, well, if you look like you're supporting the doctors and then suddenly everyone's happier in the NHS and things, then it's good for an election. Mm. But maybe politically that isn't what they want to be seen to be doing. I don't know.
Well, I think they think giving into any union is a weakness. It's seen by their voters as such anyway. I really can't understand why they're so dogged about the NHS, apart from it being an ideological thing that they fundamentally, despite everything they say, would rather the whole thing just went away and they were allowed to bring in American companies and make money out of it.
Well, I do think that's part of it, is just sort of trying to siphon in. And because there is pockets of it that's kind of privatized and all. And it's never any better. If anything, it makes it just more kind of complicated and convoluted. And they talk about bringing in all the technology and, oh, we're going to have all this AI and things. You know, it takes you 12 minutes to log onto a computer at the moment, you know, and we're still using bleeps. And there's lots of basic infrastructure. The buildings, oh, my goodness, the buildings.
Yeah. What,
you know, if it was Grand Designs, they would tell you to give up straight away. You know, it's that kind of...
You'll never fix that.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm currently going through a house building renovation at the moment, and so I'm looking around more at sort of infrastructure, and you're just like, this is a hospital. You know, it's just... the problem is getting trapped in PFIs as well, you know, this whole private finance initiative where companies build the hospitals and then rent them out and things like that. And then any alterations you want doing on them cost, you know, thousands and thousands. There's all these. What happens is you'll hear a different story about things that are sort of undermining things in the NHS, and it almost is exhausting to hear it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost, it's like not another thing that's kind of big side. But the thing, realistically, with such a large organization, you're always going to have a few rotten corners of it, aren't you? And it's trying to make it as good as possible. It's lots of things. I mean, you look at, you know, management as well and the sort of salaries they're on. And then, you know, if something goes wrong, it's never the management's fault. They'll, you know, move on to another job or, you know, another part of the NHS. And I don't, you know, management isn't as accountable as being in medicine. You know, obviously we've got regulatory bodies and things, but, you know, it's just like in, I guess, in the corporate world, you know, people can just leave and go somewhere else. You know.
So in fact, obviously, then the thing to do is decide, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write a book and I'm going to become a stand-up comedian. And then I'll make my fortune.
Exactly.
That'll be it. Yeah. But what inspired you to write the book?
I think what happened was, well, I know what happened. What happens is you do medical school, then you do a couple of years doing your foundation years. So your first few years as a doctor. And then there's a natural break after that period where some people take a bit of time off to go and work abroad or they explore different career options. The system was designed, I think, to get people into training paths quicker, but I think it's such a grueling first couple of years that people want to take a break and, you know, explore different things like work abroad, like I said. So at that pit time, comedy had started taking off. So I took some time off to focus more on that, as well as still working clinically and doing some teaching and things. And then I thought about doing anaesthetics. Always thought it would be something that would suit me personality-wise, but I was always scared of the idea of it as well. A bit like comedy. I used to love going watching comedy when I was younger. My brother used to sneak me into a club in Nottingham, Just the Tonic, and I was fascinated, love watching it. And the idea of doing it was just terrifying. The same with anaesthetics as well. Oh my goodness, you know, because the opposite of what you do, you know, if you went to your GP and they made you unconscious and paralyzed you, that's generally quite a problem. But you know, that's the now the day job sort of thing. So it was just the polar opposite of what you learned. And one of my friends who was anaesthetist said to me that, don't worry about everything you feel like you don't know. It's almost like starting medicine again when you do anaesthetics, because you do come from a different viewpoint. And it was like that. So I started anaesthetics and everything every single day was fascinating, but only because it was new to me. And I was acutely aware that the moment I got used to this, it's less fascinating. So I wrote down notes every day of things I was doing. And I thought this will be interesting for a book at some point. So I wrote down notes every day. And then obviously we went into what happened with all the pandemic. And it brought into focus what anaesthetics and anaesthetists do and are, because we were manning all the intensive cares, which, you know, historically it was all intensive care was all manned by anaesthetists, but we were all taken back there. So I think it just brought everything into focus. Plus the fact that all my live work, all the other work I was doing had stopped whilst all that was going on. So my real outlet creatively was just writing. So that's how it all came together, is that I got all the notes I had written from before, plus everything that was going on now. And then I was just able to sort of focus it into the book from then.
Wow. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? Well, you obviously you've got used to it, but the idea that in order when somebody is critically ill, that you basically take all the strain off them by bringing them right back to the basic thing of just keep that heart beating and keep them breathing. Or in fact, if you don't need that, we'll assist you with breathing, but just make sure that you go back to really almost a simple being. Everything else stops. And you're doing that with medicine. You're giving them drugs to stop their brain panicking, stop all those things happening.
Yeah, well, medicine or poison, depending on how you look at it.
Well, yeah.
I mean, this was one of the things I was really fascinated with, and I mentioned in the book too, was the one of the drugs we use is muscle relaxants and anaesthetics. So these are the paralyzing drugs, which are based on the plant poison curare. And it was discovered by someone, because they were used by indigenous tribes, probably still are, to hunting animals. So they would paralyze animals and stop them breathing. And back in that time, the surgeons were struggling to do their surgery because patients were moving around. But if you give someone too much anaesthetic, then you're at risk of causing them harm then as well. So the muscle relaxants came in to sort of aid surgery in certain areas. And it just fascinates me that we've developed it from an arrow poison, essentially.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Mm. Just last night, I was watching David Attenborough talking about a frog. They've discovered a chemical on the skin of this frog that is 50 times more effective at pain-killing than morphine.
Oh, wow. I've not heard of that.
It was one of those, are they an arrow frog? I think it may be one of those. They've got poison on their skin that puts animals off from eating them. But it also, sadly, talked about hundreds and hundreds of frogs going into extinction every year.
Because we're now taking them for the pain relief, is that why?
Probably, almost certainly, we're sucking on their backs. Lick a frog, that's the idea.
That's the next level of street dealing, isn't it? It's the amphibians just being marketed on the street.
Possibly. I don't know. Anyway, so Catch Your Breath. Did you give it that title because you felt like you needed to?
I was thinking of a title for the book, and there was nothing obvious at the time, and we were going through the last couple of years, and I was just thinking, what's going to encapsulate both anaesthetics and also what was going on? Because the book, some people have described as being almost like in two halves. Mm. And it's actually quite difficult when you're trying to think of something. I find that it's always the spur of the moment things. And I remember it. I was in Devon with my other half, and I was just coming down the stairs, and it was probably about four steps down, and I just said, oh, Catch Your Breath, maybe that's the one. Because I always thought something had to do with breath, because essentially, that's, you know, the number one thing that anaesthetists do is looking after people who can breathe. But at the same time, it was referring to us as well as the practitioners.
Yeah.
It had a reflection on how we were feeling too. So it nicely put that in perspective, I felt.
Mm. So is the tour going to be a re-look at that book from a stand-up point of view?
Well, interestingly, no. Ah. So the tour is different to the book. The title for the tour I have borrowed from the book, but I thought it was nice in terms of marketing as well. So people obviously know from me. But the actual...
And at the end of the show, you can say, now, none of the stuff I've done today is in my book, but it's available at the back of the theatre.
I do touch on the book. It does come in. But there is another really, I would say, one of the most important stories I've been involved with that holds that show together. And it was just something I explore in the show. And so it's a really important message I want to get out. And so when I first told this story, you get kind of nervous when you're telling a story for the first time. But the reaction to people was just fascinating, especially afterwards as well. And I took a work in progress up in 2022. And then this year I brought it up as a full show. I went for a couple of weeks at The Stand. And it was just a brilliant, brilliant run. It will lean from the book. There will be parts of it. But if you've got the book, there's more for you in the show as well. So it's best of both worlds, isn't it, if you think about it?
Well, very exciting times. But I don't know if any of that's going to come up when we talk to you about the things you've chosen to put into a time capsule. But it'll be interesting to find out. We'll see where it goes. So have you chosen some things for me?
I have, yes. So the first one, and I feel this is... When I thought about the things that I would put in a time capsule, this popped into my head and I was like, oh, it's so obvious, but it's obvious for a reason. And I'm sure there's lots of other people that talk about similar items or things or persons, but one of our dogs is called Nelly. She would definitely be in the time capsule. So I met Nelly the first time I met my wife, and I feel that there was a real important connection between me and Nelly that basically got the confirmation.
You thought, I like that dog so much, I think I'll go out with this girl.
Well, it was the other way around. I think the dog liked me so much that I was accepted.
Right.
But I've always been a dog person. I think I've really wanted a dog, but we've never been a family that had one. My mum would never want a dog in the house. So one of her best friends has a dog, and it was only allowed in the kitchen, nowhere else in the house. Uh-huh. We had a pet when I was younger, a cat. And when I was one, I think I got the cat. But apparently I chose the name for the cat when I was 1 year old. And do you know what I chose for the name?
Pooh.
Polly Perkins. Now,
that's good.
I don't think that came out of a 1 year old's mouth, though.
Yes, maybe not.
So we had Perko, as we called it, for like 17 years. And again, see, Perko wasn't allowed in the rest of the house, apart from the kitchen. And just we had this little conservatory bit outside as well, just in those areas.
Wow, you had control over a cat.
Well, I mean, the cat had the whole outside world and a little bit of the indoor world. And then at Christmas, she was allowed up because I'd always get a box of chocolates or something from Perko, basically, which was always amazing. But I've always loved dogs. I think my dad has as well. And I'm not sure he actually had dogs when he was younger, but he was always around dogs and things like that. But my mum was just staunchly against dogs anywhere in the house. So when I met Joe with Nelly, Joe came over to my parents' house for the first time. And of course she had Nelly, which Nelly was like just one. So she would normally go everywhere. And there was an acceptance that Nelly was allowed to come, not just be in the kitchen, but allowed in the lounge. And I was like, wow. Oh my goodness, yeah. So come in. And then we've got this rug on the floor as well. Mum and Dad had this rug, you know, one of these sort of round, expensive ones that you get once in a lifetime sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So Nelly like comes in and then she just starts going wild on this rug. So like head on the rug and then just starts scraping all around it. So we're sort of, me and Joe sort of apologizing for Nelly, but my mum's eyes just lit up as soon as she met Nelly. She's a brown cockapoo, and she can turn it on. Like, my dad absolutely loved her straight away. My mum loved her as well. But now what's happened is from that first meeting, my family, from that, my mum and dad now allow Nelly all over the house. So that was the first thing. So we've gone from nowhere allowed in the house to suddenly allowed on my mum's bed. You know,
you weren't even allowed on her bed.
Well, no, Nelly would just run up and jump on the mum. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, but mum's absolutely fine with it. Add to that, my brother then got a dog as well.
Right.
So my brother, who's staunchly against it, so now he has a little dog too. And then the other thing is that now my brother's going away and doesn't have anywhere to look after the dog. My mum and dad are now going to be looking after the dog. So we've gone full circle from absolutely staunch no dog. Then this was all from Nelly, who introduced my family to a world of dog that could be nice and not, you know.
It's a good job you and Joe got on.
I know. So it just completely changed the dynamic of the Patrick family in that sense. So we completely now accept dogs. We've also just got another dog a couple of weeks ago as well, Fig, a little Cocker Spaniel. She's just 11 weeks old now as well. It's just completely changed. And it's just fascinating to look back and think, wow, we really weren't a dog house at all. And now we are all over it. I mean, hats off to Joe for bringing up Nelly the way she was. So, yeah, so that would be the first thing I'd want to. Obviously, I don't want to bury Nelly now. That would be traumatic.
No, but obviously not. No. Okay, all right, Ed, that's the first thing. So what's number two?
So number two links into medicine, because I was thinking about this, and there's a lot of moments I think you'd want to put in a time capsule. And it's almost moments that it's difficult to explain or see, but the moment I put in for me would be the first day of medical school, probably a little bit like halfway through the day, because there's this wonderful feeling of achievement when you get into something like medical school. You know, it's a vocation. You know what you're going to be doing for the next few years. And I think when you're that age, it's such a valuable thing to have, because it's such a flux environment, you know, sort of going through late teenagerhood to sort of 20s and things. And I went through that period of like not knowing what I was going to do and what focus was. So to have that sort of period of focus of 5 years where you knew you were going to do medical, it was great. But also, there was nothing else you had to think about or worry about. It was the first day. You weren't expected to be a doctor then. You were in the process. And what a lovely thing to be part of that experience, to know that the world's a kind of oyster ahead of you and there's so much to learn. But there's, you know, you can just enjoy that moment, because from that moment onwards, it's a completely different set of scenario of worrying about almost everything, where you're constantly trying to churn information into you, trying to learn everything that you possibly can. Then obviously getting into the world of jobs and then what you need to worry about with those. So that first moment of medical school where you can really sort of sit back and think of all the things, like learning anatomy or learning the physiology of things. It was such a beautiful moment to have that. And like I said, a real sense of achievement, because getting into medical school was always a tough thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you go straight from school?
I didn't go straight from school, no. So I did another degree beforehand.
But that helps, doesn't it? I mean, it's very difficult to go straight from school to medical school. I'm not sure is the right decision.
Well, yeah. In America, they do obviously a degree and then go into medical school as a postgrad.
Mm.
Both the options are open. You can go as a graduate. There's less places as a graduate.
Is that why you only did 5 years?
So it's 5 years undergrad and then two years on a on your foundation training. But medical school will be 4 or 5 years.
Mm.
If you do a straight postgraduate course, which is just postgraduates, it's a 4-year intensive course. I went to Aberdeen, which is an undergraduate university, and that's 5 years.
At that age, it must seem like an eternity almost. I mean, I remember going to university and thinking, 3 years, I'm going to be here. This is extraordinary. So the idea of thinking 5 years of study in this place before I actually go out and start doing practice, as it were, that must have seemed like, well, when I'm an old man.
Yeah, you already feel like an old man when you're a graduate anyway. So so you sort of appreciate the time, but it was almost like the stability of knowing that you had something to look forward to in progression. So it was a really valuable moment that first day. But yeah, going through it, suddenly the stakes are raised every single year. Everything you're doing in medical school now suddenly has an impact on the job you're going to get, where you're going to get it. And you have no real say or control where you're going to get that job, you know.
Mm.
So lots of factors then started playing in.
Yeah, and you're surrounded by incredibly intelligent people.
Yeah.
I mean, but to get into medical school, you have to be bright or you have to be astonishingly studious. But generally, I think people have a natural intelligence for taking in information and assimilating it. And that's quite daunting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's you are surrounded by a lot of, you know, talented people. And that's the thing we go back to at the moment. You know, it's a lot of work. You have to obviously fund yourself through medical school. You've got exams to do, tough exams. You finish medical school and that's not the end of it. You know, you then have to do other exams on your specialty as well. So anaesthetics, you've got some of the hardest exams out of the whole medical world, which you then fund. You've got to pay for all these things. So this goes back to, you know, people, will they keep choosing it as a career with that amount of effort, with that amount of debt that you've got to put in, paying for all these things? Because you want to attract the best people you can get into medicine. What I'm trying to get across with that moment as well, it is, you know, everyone can feel that moment. You know, we didn't know anything about medicine then. You know, we knew about sciences and we knew how to get into medical, but in terms of actually practicing as a doctor, you know, imagine you were told that. It's literally, you know, a really sort of feeling that anyone could have had, because we all felt, oh my goodness, should I be here and stuff like that. But just the moment to know that the pressure was off, you know, you were lucky enough to sort of be in medical school and just appreciate it without any of the consequences of knowing what you're going to have to learn and stuff. It was just a moment, just a moment to savor. And then from everything then onwards, it's just admin and
taking notes
and
then trying to remember them. Yeah. Terrifying. But it's interesting that you also described it as knowing that you had those next 5 years, that there was a certainty to it.
Yeah.
And it's odd. Well, I suppose maybe it's a reaction to that, that you've now moved into an area where there is no certainty at all. So you've sort of gone, well, I'm going to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah. Well, for me, I was always doing bits and bobs. Like I said, comedy was something from a really early age. But the thing about medicine is that it's so all-encompassing. And I think part of the problem is for working doctors there's so much expected of you with little downtime. Mm. You know, a full-time working doctor is 48 hours a week.
Yeah.
Now, that gives you little time outside. And like anything in life, if you've got a job that's intense, what you need is the outside things to kind of help you recover and recuperate.
Right.
And for me, writing and comedy has been that. I did notice how much I missed comedy and performing when we weren't able to do it.
Mm.
But it definitely has an impact. And I would say that, you know, for me, I wouldn't be able to do one without the other.
Mm.
So I wouldn't be able to do comedy without medicine. And it makes me a better doctor.
Yeah.
Definitely makes me a better doctor. And I noticed the times when I'm not doing shows or not writing as much. It, for me, it's a real sort of yin yang of having both of them.
It is brilliant because so many comedians I've spoken to say, my problem is, what do I do when I'm not doing comedy? They so love doing comedy. They so enjoy it. And it can become an obsession that it's, what do I do in my normal life? So
yeah.
You've got the perfect answer.
Well, I don't know. It's stressful. But yeah. And there's lots of things you've got to balance with it. But it certainly balances it out. And it's strange really to say that it makes me a better doctor, but it does. Just as well as it being a release, it just that there's natural skills in comedy that really lend itself to medicine. So, you know, that building rapport with patients, you know, working in high stakes sort of situations, stressful environments, it's something that does certainly add to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, having a bit of comedy, if you can lace it in there, does always help a bit of release in the NHS as well. So,
yes.
So yeah, it just happens to balance it out for me.
Perfect.
And the first couple of years when I was doing, because I came down from Aberdeen and I was doing comedy at the same time, but I never really told anyone about it. In hospital, I never told anyone about it.
Mm.
And the reason was I had a show down south and I asked for a day off or something like that. And I got called into an office and I was like, oh, they're going to say, oh, well done you for carrying on with all your extracurricular activities and stuff. And I actually got pretty much told off for asking for such a thing. So I thought, oh my goodness, I can't possibly tell anyone this at all.
No.
And then, so I was doing this strange moonlighting thing where I was, I would do like a gig and then a night shift and like don't tell anyone about it sort of thing in the hospital. And then there was a consultant who was just looking over things I'd done and a CV sort of thing, and saw this that I'd mentioned it on here. He said, oh, why don't I know anything about this? And I was like, oh, well, I thought it wouldn't be looked upon highly and I'd be told off sort of thing. And he said, no, you know, I play in a band, you know, if I'd much rather work with someone that does something else than someone that doesn't do anything else. And I think, to be honest, that is a modern thing.
Yeah.
I think in the olden days, you were expected to fully commit to that and nothing else and not even have a life outside.
No.
Well, I'm probably being extreme here.
No, I think it's true. I knew doctors who said, you know, it's really difficult to have a family.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's headed more that way where they want people to... I'm eating my glasses. we want people to be doing different things. It's a release, as I said, for me, and it also keeps me doing medicine. And I think the same with other people as well,
yeah.
Is that if you run people completely on empty, then at some point they're just going to leave or not be able to do the job. So I think they're now realizing having people being able to be flexible, do different things. So I do think that's been a big sea change.
Yeah. Well, it's a relief now that if you're on stage and you have to shout out, I'm sorry, is there a doctor in the house apart from me? You're glad when somebody says yes, because up until that point, you were going, oh, God, don't tell anyone I'm here.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the whole idea of having a sense of humour and an ability to deal with people, it's always been one of the things people have complained about, some doctors, that they don't seem to have that connection with people. They're fantastic at their job, but they don't know how to communicate it.
Yeah, they're called surgeons.
Ah, that's right, yeah. Okay, well, fantastic. I can't imagine anything better than having achieved such a thing as getting into medical school and then realising that actually it's okay. So let's put that in there.
Absolutely.
That's only number two.
I know, only number two.
So what's number three? Okay, time to leave Ed and move on to Ad. We'll be back when people stop trying to sell you things.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome back. That's the ads. Let's get back to Ed's time capsule.
So, number three is the Bruntsfield Links golf course, the pitch and putt golf course in Edinburgh. If you ever go to Edinburgh, the Fringe, there is a pitch and putt. It's free to play, and it's like a 36-hole, I would say golf course, but it's like a pitch and putt, but 36 yeah. holes, basically, which is quite a lot. There's all these little white flags, so it's just beyond the meadows in Edinburgh, and there's a place called the Golf Tavern, which you can go and, like, you know, rent a club from, sort of thing, and you can go and play. So it's just, anyone can go and do it. And when I was at university first time with a friend, I basically started playing there. We were so bad, right? We were so bad, but we were desperate to make it a competition. And we would commentate on each other as well. Like when we were hitting a shot, it'd be at the third tee, here he comes. Oh, he's duffed. And it was just a beautiful moment. But what that started was a bonding of a friendship, so that I'd never played the game before then. And we now get together and it's part of our friendship. We go away, we go and watch like the British Open and stuff. Mm. And it all stems back to how terrible we were and still are at the game of golf. And one of the most beautiful moments I've ever had is that you ever seen The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon?
Yeah.
So we were inspired by that because we love food, and it was on when we were at uni, and we saw some of the places and we thought, oh, it'd be amazing to go to one of them. So we saved up and we planned and we went to Longclume, which is in Cartmel. Mm. And the deal was that it's obviously these places are quite expensive to go to,
yes.
but there was a deal on and it was called the Romantic Package. And if you got it, the basically you got the room, you got some dinner and stuff like that. And so we decided that that was the best thing to do, thinking that'd be fine. So we got to the room. Of course, it was a Romantic Package. We booked it. So they just put Dear Mr. and Mrs. Lee, which didn't even use my surname. I was gutted about that. But what happened was that morning we played golf on a little trip, and we were soaking wet, and we came into that room. The package was they gave you a bottle of fizz as well. And we sat in our boxer shorts with a bottle of fizz between us, and we watched golf on TV. And it was one of the greatest moments ever. And I remember Tom saying to me that, you know, he could actually marry me right now. And it was one of the best moments we'd had, I think. So we look back. So we always have those moments whenever we're going away. It all goes back to the pitch and putt. And it's so funny. It's like when you go to primary school and the place is massive. The school is huge. And then you go back later in life and it's such a small thing.
Yes.
And strangely, despite being, you know, a fully grown adult, when I started hitting a golf ball, that place now seems so much smaller.
Well, you played on full-size courses, of course. Now.
Yeah, exactly.
So you suddenly think, hang on a minute, I really like a pitch and putt course. There's a 9-hole course near me, and I used to play it with my son when he was just turned a teenager. So it was perfect because he was beginning, I'm rubbish. And so we were about the same level. Now he's 6'2" and can hit a ball 300 yards, so I don't stand a chance.
It's envious, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's enviable.
Well, it's a good job that you and Tom have, in a way, stayed at the same level. You've sort of grown together so that you now can still play each other competitively. Or do you just put him off by commentating?
Well, we still do a bit of the commentating as well. We've got to be careful, though. I think, so Dom Holland, you know Dom Holland?
Mm-hmm.
So I play golf with him a few times, and he put... he put in one of his blogs, which I think is possibly an accurate reflection, he described me as being, for someone whose job is to put needles in very specific places, it's slightly unnerving that he can't put a golf ball in a hole from 3 feet away.
Yep. Don't tell your patients. Do you know, I can't believe how many people choose things from Edinburgh. What a fantastic city it is.
It's got everything about it. You can get around it quite easy, and it get every sort of corner you're seeing something quite magnificent too. And I lived there for a few years. Mm. So, I mean, I did, I used to be a rickshaw driver in Edinburgh as well. You know,
really?
The bicycles that take people around. Yeah.
With those hills? Oh, my word.
With those hills. Yeah. So you'd look for the tips on those hills, I'll tell you.
I'm not surprised.
What a city to make that work as well. So you'd always get people like on, you know, on stag do's and they'll want a race. And you'd fake having a race, always in the grass market. Oh,
yeah.
You'd fake having a race because if you'd properly had a race, you'd burn yourself out. And it wasn't worth it for the small winning fee that you'd get because you've got another 6 hours to keep going, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I saw all parts of Edinburgh with that too. And yeah, I love going back there out with the festival too. I guess almost in a way, the festival changes it in your mindset because you're so focused on doing your show and having things ready for that. It's Edinburgh, you don't probably get to fully appreciate it. In fact, I really love the Fringe that I just did because I did go up for a limited amount of shows. Mm. You know, it's an apocalyptic number of people visit that city, mm-hmm. but there's still space in the right places. Yeah,
yeah. Amazing. Yes. And this time you wouldn't have to cycle around it, which I think would be a great boon. I can't imagine attempting some of those hills. Amazing. Okay, so we've got two left. We've got one you want to keep and one you'd like to bury and forget. So it's up to you, whichever order you want to do it in.
Oh my goodness, I actually got too many.
All right, okay. What have you got?
I actually got two more good ones.
Well, tell me them both. You can choose.
I'll let you choose one, yeah.
Okay.
So one of the ones I would definitely want to keep in a time capsule is a Fiddler gig. So Fiddler, are a band, is an acronym. Is that the right word? Acronym?
Yeah,
it stands for, you know, it's not the most savoury sort of thing. So I don't know how sweary we're allowed to be on this podcast.
You can swear if you want to.
Well, it's Fiddler, F-I-D-L-A-R.
Let me guess what the first word is.
Yes.
Is it flip?
It's not. It's not. but it's F it dog, life's a risk, basically. They're a surf punk band from America, and they are... So I remember listening to them when I was driving to a gig. Years ago, and I was listening to them on the radio, and I was just suddenly entranced by it. And then I listened to the rest of the music, and I then went to see them. And I've never had this before where I've gone to see a band live, and the music is a utterly different level to what it was recorded, like completely.
Yeah.
And I was just absolutely mesmerized. The crowd were amazing as well. It was just, you know, it was such a raucous atmosphere, lots of mosh pits, sweaty, you know. You wear clothes that you never want to see again afterwards, basically. And you might have people fall over themselves and things, but everyone's sort of helping each other back up. And it was just, it was great. So that was first time I went to that was years ago. And I think I've seen them four times since they, when they come back over here. And the most recent time was a couple of weeks ago. And it was just the same.
Yeah.
It was just the same. And I was almost worried when I got there, would it be the same as it was before? Because this is the first time I've seen them since, you know, for years ago. Joe, my wife, had bought me tickets. And we went, and it was a very sort of muted atmosphere. Like, there was someone in a barber jacket, and I was like, oh my God, I've got old. I've become old. Oh my goodness, what is going on? I cannot understand this. Anyway, so I was sort of in this moment of just reflecting on life and, you know, maybe, you know, things move on and change. And then what happened was everyone just started piling in literally minutes before they were on. And I suddenly realized the reason was because I'd never actually been so early at a Fiddler. I've got old because I turned up so early.
You turned so up on early. Time.
Like 3 hours before they were on.
Yes.
And normally you just turn up and they're on.
Need to get a decent seat.
Yeah, yeah. But it was just absolutely brilliant. And like, it was the first time Joe had seen, and then they created a mosh pit in the middle and she just suddenly disappeared. So it's such a great experience. And the following week we went to see a pianist called Riopi.
I've had Riopi on this podcast. He's an amazing
Oh,
man.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's amazing. And actually went to Oxford as well.
Right.
So he did music here.
Mm.
I'd seen Fiddler and then Riopi literally in the same week. And it couldn't be sort of more different styles. It was such a wonderful sort of thing. But the Fiddler gig is just something completely out of this world. It's almost like it's a mixture of going to a club, going to the gym because it's a proper workout as well, But just a huge sort of endorphin thing too. So.
And you're right, you absolutely cannot capture that on a recording.
Yes, it's the live experience more than anything. Because I think sometimes the studio albums all kind of craft and things, but, you know, it's one of the times I just remember being, oh my goodness, this is nothing like I remember even hearing it, you know. And you can pick out songs that you know are going to be, wow, this is going to be great live. So,
fantastic. So it was great. Yeah. Fuck it, dog, life's a risk. That's great. Well, let's find out what the other one is. And I don't care. So I'm happy to break rules. I'll give you one extra.
Oh, who's this guy coming up with five good things he wants to put in his time capsule? He's had too much of a good time.
His life has been so full.
Yeah. So this is more of a moment. And I think this is a moment that I'd like to think a lot of people have experienced. It's a cricket bag. I want to put a cricket bag in the time capsule. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I was on the bus. I was going to school. And my parents had bought me some cricket gear that I needed to play in this match. And I was at the bus stop and I was mucking around as you usually do. And I get on the bus and it's about 25 minutes into the ride. And I look around and I'm like, where's this bag of cricket stuff? And I haven't got it. And I must have left it at the bus stop. Now, this is the time, obviously, there wasn't mobile phones around. So this huge wave of panic kicked in because, you know, they'd spent this money and I'd lost it. Where was it going to go? And things like that. So I actually got off the bus and I walked all the way back because I didn't have money to get on another bus. So I walked all the way back to the bus stop. And at that bus stop where I'd left the cricket bag wasn't there. It'd gone.
Oh, no.
So now I'm seriously panicking. I'm like, what on earth am I going to do? And so I get the next bus. We had a bit of change, enough for us to get on a bus to go back in. Yeah. It was our dinner money, basically. So we got back in. We went all the way to the bus station and I went to the lost property. I mean, this sounds such a different era, doesn't it? I went
yes,
to the lost
quite.
Property at the bus station and there someone had seen it, picked it up, taken it in and dropped it there. And it was that moment of, oh my gosh, someone has done something so amazing for me that they have no idea how that has impacted me as a school kid.
Yeah.
And it's I think it's something that we still have today, but obviously we've got technology and we have ways of finding things or registering lost and found. There's almost some safety net. Mm. So it was a moment in time where that bag was gone, you know, that piece of something I had completely disappeared, but someone had been so kind and I'll never meet that person. I'll never know.
No. The chances are it's a sequence of people. It really is when they say the kindness of strangers. It may have passed through several hands,
yeah,
but all of them have been trusted to look after it because they know that it's someone else's and to them it's precious.
Yeah. And you also just have no idea the impact that has on other, on someone else. I did have one experience of the impact and I guess this made me think about it in terms of, you know, what happened to me, but also didn't realise the impact it had on someone else. I was, again, a bus. regular on the buses. But I was on the bus and I found a mobile phone. Now, this is mobile phones before iPhones. Again, I was still like a kid. And I got off and I went to a police station and handed it in because they were at that stage where I was like, well, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah.
And obviously they take your name and number and stuff like that. So I remember my mum saying, you've got a telephone call. And I called and it was the mother of someone whose phone it was. Yes. And they'd obviously bought it as a present. They just said, just so grateful that I'd, you know, handed it in and said, just wanted to say thank you.
Mm.
And I think that's the thing is that it's such a small thing that you can do or someone does. To see something that someone's left and the amount of distress the other person is in, that small act of someone doing something like that has such huge impact on someone else, which is such a beautiful thing to do and realise as well. You know, my goodness, that person who picked up that cricket bag went all the way to the bus station just to hand it in. And, you know, what a great thing it was. And so, and it's, like I said, it's beautiful because it's something that is still today we can experience despite all the technology and things you got. It was just a moment that you realize that really the kindness of strangers and the impact that can have.
Yes. And it does happen all the time. That's the wonderful thing about it. When it doesn't happen, that's when you're surprised.
Oh gosh, yeah.
So one thing that you want to get rid of, that's all we have left.
So one thing that I would put in and I'm afraid I have to bury, and it's a poison chalice in more than one way, is oysters. Oysters have been responsible for one of the greatest memories I've had and also several of the not so greatest memories I've had. And, you know, it started off, it might have been, you know, Borough Market. Mm-hmm. I think it was there. Like, there's a place that sold oysters, like, and they looked amazing. I was like, oh, well, let's have it. And I remember just eating one in the market and I was like, wow, this is crazy. This is great. So what happened was when I was younger, I went away with my brother to New York for a trip, and he took me to a place, one of his favorite places, which is called Balthazar. Mm-hmm. I said, what's it like? He said, it's basically a Parisian bistro without the Parisians, is what he described it as. I was like, okay. So you go in, and he said, you've got to sit at the bar. And we sat at this bar, and it was like the most indulgent I think I've ever felt ever. We sat at this bar, and you ordered some oysters that come on the big ice tray and have some wine. And then everyone's chatty in New York. It's not like it was, you know, everyone wants to talk to you. You just kept chatting. So we spent hours just chatting to people around us. And it was all just, you know, really sort of sociable, fun experience. So I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And then I had an oyster when I was away. It was something from medicine. It was a medical elective where I was looking into ski and snowboard sports injuries as part of a project. And I was in Montana first. And then we went somewhere else in San Francisco. And I had an oyster there. And I thought I'd been poisoned by some secret agents. And I was thoroughly unwell, thoroughly. Now, apparently there's something about norovirus being in oysters and it's all a bit of a potluck sort of thing, depending on how much of the virus is in there or whether in it. So, you know, you might get ill or not. But anyway, there's also the theory that you might develop an allergy or intolerance to shellfish. And I remember I was away with a friend and we were late getting to this hotel. We were in Scotland. And on our way there, we called up and just said, can we get some food? Because we're going to arrive quite late. And they said, yeah, you want to order now because we're going to shut the kitchen. Mm. For some reason, they just had a special. They had oysters on the menu. The starter. And so we thought, oh, right, we'll both have some oysters and then a burger because that seems like a natural sort of combination.
Surf and turf, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we said, okay, we'll go for that. And everything was great. We went to bed about an hour and a half afterward and then just something started happening in the bedroom. I just felt like beads of sweat coming down my forehead. God. And I suddenly started to feel more and more nauseous. And I just thought, maybe it's just, you know, it's just all the traveling. And then it became apparent it wasn't the traveling. And then I had to go in. And, you know, my poor friend didn't witness, but audibly witnessed the changing of a man in that room. And, you know, sometimes your body puts strains on you, whether, you know, if you're going to be sick or otherwise. And if you've only got one toilet and both ends of your body are requiring it, you have to make an informed decision. And I have to say that it was one of the most, the words when once everything had died down, there were some words came from the bedroom and said, are you okay? And I said, yes, but I've got some bad news. And he said, what is it? And I said, I think you're going to need a new toothbrush. So oysters, I'm yet to try, because that was the last two times I tried it years ago.
Don't, I cannot understand. If you said to someone, there's this food, which you may find delicious, but usually that's because it's got lemon or some chili on it. And yet having this quite delicious food might mean you spend 12 hours lying on the floor of a bathroom, vomiting and shitting. You sort of go, I won't bother then. So I'm quite happy to put oysters into the time capsule for you and maybe keep you away from them because I think it's a bad decision.
One day, I think if I've got like a safe space, you know, if I've got, you know, working hygiene facilities, I'm on my own and I'm wearing swimming trunks or something, you know.
Surrounded by doctors, yes.
Exactly.
Ed, how fantastic. Thank you very much. It was really lovely to hear the six things you want to put into a time capsule. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome. And thanks for letting me cram another one in there.
That's all right. Have fun with the tour.
Will do. Thank you.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Ed Patrick. Thanks for listening. Remember, you can listen to this podcast without ads if you follow the link in the description of this podcast and subscribe to Acast Plus, where you also get a bonus episode every week. Woo! Yeah, don't get too excited. It's just me and my producer slash son, although I'd never slash my son, talking about the making of the podcast and anything else that occurs. Do join us if you can. If you subscribe to this podcast, of course, we'll send you every episode as they become available. And of course, as every podcast says, please do rate or review us if you have the chance. Just click on 5 stars or write something effusive. The theme tune is available to download or stream on Spotify. It was written and performed by Pass the Peas Music, and I'm sure you know that this is a cast-off production for Acast, produced by the aforementioned slash son, John Fenton Stevens.
Well, this is an opportunity, isn't it? To have a doctor on a podcast that always ends with a joke? Ha ha, let's go through some of my favourites. Doctor, I'm wrapping my genitals in cling film. Yes, I can clearly see your nuts. Doctor, I keep thinking I'm a pair of curtains. Well, pull yourself together. Doctor, I think I'm a dog. Then get off the sofa. But my favourite is not necessarily the funniest, but it kept me and my relatives laughing for a ridiculously long time many years ago. We'd all just come back from a very long evening in the pub. In fact, the man who told the joke was brilliant at laughing the joke in. A bit like Barry Cryer. So here goes. A man goes to the doctor and says, Doctor, I just can't stop farting. And the doctor says, Right, can you pass me that very long, very heavy pole? The man looks worried and says, Well, what are you going to do with that? And the doctor says, I'm going to open the window. Oh, come on, we were drunk. Bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.